Well, hello, I'm Stephen Downs, and it's a pleasure to be here at Ed Media 2009 here in Honolulu, Hawaii. I'm introducing this mostly for the benefit of the people listening on audio, because the people who are here already know where they are. Last minute setup of the microphone.
Oh, you're going to turn down that echo a little bit? Thank you.
My talk today is titled Beyond Management, the Personal Learning Environment. And that means I have two components to the talk, the Beyond Management part and the Personal Learning Environment part. And so there's going to be an element of theory in what I have to say, and there's going to be an element of practicality in what I have to say. And as is usual for my kind of talks, it will be difficult to distinguish the part that is theoretical and the part that is practical. And people leaving the room may still be searching for the practical and the theory, but that can't be helped. Like you, I was here yesterday to hear the keynote from Tara Ramazan. Sorry, George is a much better person at pronouncing names than I am. And I know well the whisper of audio in my ear. No, it's not my conscience. As a child, I used to listen to baseball games and set up the radio on the dresser. The dresser was here, except it was this tall. And I'd set up the radio on my little, and I'd put it underneath the towel, and then I'd take the earphone jack, run the earphone jack down behind the dresser, under the carpet, all the way over, and then there were bunk beds, myself and my brother John, and so we had a split in the line, and my little earphone was just a single, remember those single little earphone buds, and be mine, and his would go up to the, he had the upper bunk, I don't know why, and we'd sit there and we'd listen to the Montreal Expos play on the West Coast in the middle of the night, and some of my greatest memories are listening to those baseball games. And now even here in Hawaii, I found myself yesterday listening to the baseball game, no more Montreal Expos, of course, a fact that I mourn greatly, and I will never lose my allegiance to my Montreal Expos, but I was listening to the Blue Jays games. A poor substitute, but nonetheless a substitute. And you know, when Tara was speaking yesterday and talking about the effect of audio, my instant reaction, and I tweeted this, and it would have shown up on the Twitter. I was hoping to have huge text. Maybe we can get huge text at some point. And my reaction was, yeah, a little, the audio whispering in the ear kind of jumps over that little part in our brain that is critical awareness, reflection. It sort of takes a straight circuit into the back of our mind and implants itself. And so I'm thinking about that when I'm preparing my paper, my presentation for today. I'm thinking about the way audio short circuits the critical reflective capacities that we have to filter, organize, and evaluate the information coming in. And I realized there's no big mystery to what we do. It turns out it is very easy to teach people. It is ridiculously easy to teach people. There are no mysteries at all about how you get people to learn things. You want somebody to become a child soldier, you put them in a room, you yell at them, you make them yell back, and you jump that little reflective, critical capacity that they have in their mind, and you put it right into their brain. We know how to do this. We've been indoctrinating each other for generations, for centuries, for as long as we've existed. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the effectiveness of different types of learning, the effectiveness of this theory, the effectiveness of that technology. Are these tests working? What are those PISA scores?
What are those TIMS results? Are they really learning mathematics? And to me, all of that is pretty much irrelevant, because we know if we really wanted to, we could indoctrinate our students and make them memorize everything we wanted. There's no mystery here. And I'm not at all interested in that kind of education. And that certainly is a big part of what I mean by beyond management. To me, beyond management means, at its heart, beyond thought control. And beyond management means, at its heart, the beginning of a system of education that is intended for the purposes and the benefit of the learner. And we are a long way away from that. But the work that I want to talk about today represents some tentative steps in that direction. Let me talk about what I do. As George mentioned, I'm a researcher for the National Research Council of Canada. I've been doing this online learning thing for a long time, since, I don't know, 1993, 94. I used to work with Athabasca University. I used to work with Assiniboine Community College. And somewhere along the way, I started taking my bookmarks, and instead of creating bookmarks, I created little 100-word essays. And somewhere along the way, I began putting them on the web. And somewhere along the way, May 5th, 2001, I began sending them out by email. And I've been collecting them, and I checked last night, and I have produced 16,171 of these. That represents the ones I've written. Okay. And if you actually look at my Google Reader stats, because I use Google Reader these days, for every 10 that I put up, there's about 80 that I read. So I do a lot of reading, and I do a lot of writing, and that has been my education in this field. What does 16,000 posts look like? Well, over the years, I've built my own system for my newsletter, because when I started, there was no really good way to send HTML newsletters with links and things like that. So I built my own system. I've been playing with this system for years, and I've drawn connections between the links. I've got a system in there that automatically organizes the links by topic, because I am not going to tag 16,000 items, especially retroactively. I had a thing I built once that actually mapped conversations. I'll resurrect that again one day, because that was really interesting. So you'd have one person post, another person reply, and you can see the links begin to form between these things. I've organized them by terminology. I've organized them by language, by nationality, by comments, causes. There's an element of social networks in here. And all of that together represents, well, chaos. And it is literally chaos. The body of knowledge in our field is best expressed with the term chaos. And this is an important lesson, because it means that what we take to be knowledge in our field, cause, effect, train, learn, repeat, memorize, is in fact not what is actually happening out there in the field. My own personal experience of our field is that it is this mishmash of chaotic, cross-connecting, densely woven networks of interactions. It's complicated, it's complex. I want to draw out that a little bit. I'm sure many of you have heard this discussion before. Complicated versus complex. Complicated means that there are many parts. Complex means that there are many variables, and they mutually reinforce each other. Complicated means that you can get at something if you work at it hard enough, look at it closely enough, have enough eyes looking at it. Bugs in software, that's complicated. Complex means you just can't get at the quote-unquote truth of the matter. Doesn't mean there's no truth, just means you can't get at it. you've probably heard the story of the butterfly, right? If a butterfly flaps its wings, sometimes it's in China, sometimes it's always far away, right? Then there'll be a tornado or whatever in Central Park or in Kansas or whatever. And if it was simply complicated, we could go get that butterfly and kill it. And thereby prevent a tornado in Central Park. But we don't, because there is no way to track that back. There is no way to find the cause of that tornado. This is expressed really well in what's sometimes called the three-body problem. Because everybody says, oh no, you know, there is a fact of the matter, like gravity. What about gravity? Everybody knows about gravity, right? Let's see if I have something here to drop. No, I don't have anything to drop. Gravity. Almost dropped on it. Right. We know about gravity. Well, if you have three bodies, like planets, each planet has gravity. The gravity of one planet affects the other planet. That's what makes the moon go around the Earth. We all know that, right? If you have three bodies, the gravity of each planet exerts an influence on the other planet, moves the other planet, which means the gravity of the other planet, which is exerting an influence on the first planet, now has changed because the planet has moved. There's no way to predict what they're going to do. You can't just, you know, write this nice simple mathematical formula. The only way to know where these planets are going to go when they're mutually affecting each other like that is to run it over and over and over. Now, there's a whole literature devoted to the three-body problem. There are some beautiful diagrams that get drawn, but the main point is there isn't a nice simple statement that is going to reflect what three bodies will do to each other when their gravity influences each other. We'll just let those planets go. Isn't that going to bother you now? Because you know those planets are. And a little existential question for you. If the web browser is obscured by the PowerPoint presentation, and there's an animation on the web page, is the animation really playing? Connectivism is about those three planets. Connectivism, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later, is the idea at its heart, and this is the fundamental wisdom of the idea. It had nothing to do with networks and stuff like that, but does. But is the idea that there isn't at heart a curriculum. There isn't at heart a body of knowledge that will tell us what those three planets are going to do. Connectivism is the idea that we have to go in there and explore it for ourselves. Or more accurately, because I want to be as perfectly, precisely accurate as I can, the content of the learning is what science fiction writers and sometimes mystery writers call the MacGuffin. The MacGuffin, and any good story has a MacGuffin. And what a MacGuffin is the thing that all the characters are about. It's the Falcon in the Maltese Falcon. It's the Lost Ark in Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'm not going to try to come up with more examples off the top. But the idea is that it's not about that content. You know, the Raiders and the Maltese Falcon is all about the interrelations between the characters and the interplay and the life lessons that they learn. But the MacGuffin is the thing that draws them along in its wake. The product of learning is not the learned. It's not the fact memorized. It's the learner. The idea here is that the learning is the development of the learner, the development of, in my mind anyways, the critical capacities, the manner, the mechanisms of reflection in the learner. In my mind, the three R's ought to and will be replaced with the three L's: language, logic, and learning. Communication, reason, growth, and development. Which leads to the first theme. I have three themes. This is the first theme. I know it took a long time to get to this first theme, but here we are. That learning is about active engagement, not passive observation. And active engagement, not passive observation, not over some kind of body of knowledge, although there may be a body of knowledge which is serving as our MacGuffin. It's a bit like actor network theory, but it isn't. It's a bit like action research, but it isn't. It's pure and simple engagement without the theorizing, without the belief that you're going to somehow get to the cause and effect kind of story. That's research, the kind of research that I'm doing, but it's also learning, the kind of learning that I'm attempting to promote. It's thinking for yourself. It's free learning. It's the learning you can, should, and would do if you were connected to a network of other learners. It's the learning you can, would, and should do if you thought about your own personal learning as improving, creating, and modifying the connections you form in your own mind. On this model, teachers are nodes in a network. Students are nodes in a network. Both teaching and learning consist of sending and receiving these communications. 16,100 word essays. This is a slide especially for Alan Levine. I've long used the philosophy of aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward as the model that informs the development of my website, the forming of the 16,000. And it never occurred to me until I was reading the conference booklet and like all the abstracts, and of course there's all these abbreviations, and I realized I should abbreviate this. And when I abbreviated this, I got ARRFF, which of course immediately made me think of Alan Levine and his Cog Dog blog. So Alan, this is for you. So that's the mechanism, that's the process that we're engaged in here. And it forces us to rethink these contents. These contents aren't the object that we're trying to acquire. These contents aren't the concepts that we're trying to memorize. These concepts are at best a MacGuffin, and more accurately, this river of data that flows past us. Tony Hurst yesterday was talking about data and freedom of the data, and it's that sort of thing that I have in mind. And all of that leads to, is there anyone who hasn't seen this diagram? The famous, there are some, okay. The famous personal learning environment diagram. This diagram was originally authored by Scott Wilson from Britain. That's why it says VLE in the center. You can always tell it's British because it's a VLE instead of anything else. And what this diagram represents is the original concept of the personal learning environment as it sort of emerged in a community of correspondents, a lot of whom are here. A lot of whom are out there on the network. And the idea here is a change in the model of educational content delivery, put that in quotes because that's not really what I mean, where instead of the institution and instead of the instructor and instead of the content being at the center, the learner is at the center. Where it says future VLE, you should insert in your own mind the words personal learning environment, and then you can scratch that out, because what we really mean is at the center of that is the learner. The learner is a node in the network. The learner is engaged in this process of communicating, aggregating, remixing, repurposing, feeding forward content to the rest of the network. and you see different types of things that are up there in the network now. You see things like 43 things, which is a to-do list. You see Flickr, which is your photos. You see Live Journal, which is your blog posts. And you see content coming from traditional educational institutions. The educational institution, the instructor, has been pushed off to the side. Not silenced, not completely cut out of the equation, but now one voice among many. So Scott Wilson built Plex. Well, Scott Wilson and the group at CITUS built Plex. Plex is probably the first prototype, one of the first prototype personal learning environments. And what Plex does is, well, it's sort of hard to describe, but it aggregates stuff and then it allows you to feed them forward. It's a first try. It doesn't do a lot, but it exhibits the principle of having an application that will connect to other applications and bring the data in into some sort of place where you can work with it. I built a few things playing around with my own tools. First thing I built was something called MyGlue. MyGlue was a simple application that took RSS feeds that were produced by blogs or other online sites. RSS feeds are simply lists of the contents of a blog expressed in XML. So it took these XML feeds from different blogs and merged them together. As you can see, three RSS feeds all get smooshed into one thing. And then I would apply a filter to it, like my topic filter or something like that, and then produce a customized output feed. So that was pretty cool. I was pretty pleased to be able to do that. But that wasn't everything I wanted. So I took my glue and I inserted it into a thing called the RSS writer. And what the RSS writer is intended to do is to allow me to do all of these things. Aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. And so on the left-hand side, you can't really see it because you just see the welcoming screen. But on the left-hand side, you have the list of resources that would be produced by MyGlue. So I have a whole bunch of resources on that left-hand side. I wonder. No, I don't have time. For those of you who are hereafter, I can pop up the example and you can have a look at it. What you do is you drag those resources into the yellow editing screen. Don't ask me why I chose yellow, but it really makes for a nice colorful graphic, doesn't it? And you can drag the text in, you can drag the images in. It's an HTML editing window, so you can start editing, resizing photos, doing whatever you want. And then the lower right-hand side is the feed forward part, and you can take that content and send it to Blogger or send it to some other online site. So the idea, this is the core of the personal learning environment right here. The idea that you can bring the stuff in, very importantly, that you can rework it, remix it, do stuff with it, evaluate it, critically appraise it, reflect on it, create one of those little 100-word essays, and then send it off, also very important, send it off to the network. Send it off to those people who might be interested in what you have to say about these particular resources. Then Scott Wilson came back with something called Feed Forward, and this is the project that he's working on now. As you can see, it's a much more sophisticated version of Plex, and it again is doing the same sort of thing. It is aggregating resources on the left-hand side, bringing them in, allowing you to remix them, and then allowing you to send them off on the right-hand side. And that seems to be, you know, coming in from the left, coming out. I suppose if there was a Hebrew version, the resources would come in on the right. Anyhow, I don't think there's any real convention there. Now, that leads to the second theme, learning and the right sort of learning. Because the idea of having a tool like this is not simply to bring stuff in, memorize it, and send it off. It is rather to engage in this more critically reflective process that is appropriate when you are working in a complex environment, which we all are. What I want to do in this second theme is to draw out a couple of concepts. Now, the concepts I want to draw out are the concepts of independence and interdependence. And these are important concepts because a lot of the time when I talk about something like the personal learning environment, the first thing that people think of is some kind of Ayn Randian personal self-dependence, or it's me against the world, Harold Rourke, all that kind of stuff. And that's like the model of simple principles, simple atomic principles. That's the billiard ball model of educational technology. The idea that if you atomize something, if you focus on the individual, you have the individual simply reacting to all the other components, but not interacting with them. I know that's kind of a messy concept, I'm sorry. When I am on the internet, me with my personal learning environment, me acting independently and not being instructed or whatever, it's not me by myself, obviously, because I'm aggregating from a network and I'm feeding forward to a network. It's me and my friends out there on the network. The sort of network, the sort of model that we're looking at really varies depending on how we structure this network. For those of you who've been following all the social network stuff, and by all the social network stuff, I'm talking about Power Laws, Clay Shirky, Duncan J. Watts, Alfred Laszlo Barabasi, all the rest. There's this model of networks that gets proposed that resembles this individual as atom kind of model. And this is the sort of network that results. It's a hub and spoke network. And what you have are the influencers that are at the center of the network, and you see the big influencer there and the other influencers and all of that. It's a network where there is a considerable degree of centralization, a considerable degree of influence. You have what is called a power law characteristic to this network. And there's a little diagram where you can sort of see it in the corner there, the red, where you have a small number of people, the Dave Weinbergers of the world, with a large number of connections. And then it tails off, and then you have the B list, with a so-and-so number of connections, and the C list, and then there's me, and the D list, with still a good number of connections. Sorry, I just like Kathy Griffin. Yeah. And then it tails off into the long tail, and the long tail is the great unwashed, who have blogs that are read by two people and their dogs. And you get that kind of network with that kind of structure. And it's a model built on this atomistic Ayn Rand personal agency big guru kind of model of the web. It's the model you get from broadcasting networks. It's the model that you have when there's a voice whispering at you in the radio. This is not the kind of network that I'm trying to build. This is the kind of network I'm trying to build. This is a mesh network. Mesh network is characterized by non-preferential attachments. You don't attach yourself to famous people, you attach yourself by friends. A mesh network is characterized by multiple attachments. Instead of attaching yourself to one or two or three major influencers, you connect yourself to a large number of, up to, say, 150 of your personal friends, your own community. The result of a mesh network is a power law that doesn't look like a power law anymore. It's a flattened, can you see the red line there, is almost horizontal. That means the influence of one person is pretty much the same as the influence of another person. Everybody gets to play. Everybody has a voice. Everybody is a contributor as well as a consumer. See, when we structure our networks to focus on the individual, you know, we have this great man theory of history and all of that, we're creating this picture of humans as independent actors that do not actually influence each other in any way. In economics, the model is the rational decision maker, right? The rational decision maker is completely unmoved by anything except purely rational self-interest. And if I can paraphrase Dr. Phil, I would say, how is that working for you? When I talk about people working independently, autonomously, in a network, in a personal learning environment, I am not talking about them working as solitary agents, completely uninfluenced and unmoved by those around them. And in fact, I'm talking quite the opposite. I'm talking about a three bodies problem, a three bodies environment where the actions of each influence the actions of the other. It doesn't control them, but it influences them. So each planet is independent, but each planet exerts an influence on the other. We have something which is much more like a mesh network, and we have something which is much more like chaos, like the real world, instead of complicated, which is the mythical world of the economic theorist. And, I might add, the mythical world of the educational theorist. We ourselves become our content. We ourselves become what we are sending out there, and we ourselves are becoming what is created through this network of interactions. There's a whole digression there I can't get into, but what I want to say is that, again, to repeat the phrase that I uttered earlier, we, the learner, is the product of the education and not some sort of a mass store of content. You know, people talked about open educational resources and repositories of learning objects and all of that. And there's been discussion, how do we sustain this? How do we create this massive body of learning resources that we're going to need? And we're all involved in the production of these resources. But if we have this model where instead of having the educational institutions that produce and the students that consume, learn, and memorize, then we have a model of production of educational resources where the dominant paradigm is to share rather than to produce and to consume. And in my view, and again, this is another digression I can't go into, but in my view, this is the only sustainable model of production of learning resources. The only possible model is where the learners themselves produce the resources. And, you know, again, there's a whole dialogue I want to go off on the whole concept of sustainable and sustainability, because it drags us into this model of learning where learning is about the content, learning is about the value of production, learning is about the cost of producing textbooks, learning is about some kind of economic system, rather than learning being engagement in the community, engagement in the network. But I can't go off into that digression now, so that will have to do. I have a second butterfly thesis, because people always tell me, this will never work, it's too idealistic. People need some kind of incentive, they need to belong to some kind of institution to produce these learning resources. We need authorities, we need management, we need control, and I say, it's not true, and it's demonstrably not true. I don't know about where you guys live, but where I live, people take, sometimes they make them, sometimes they buy them, these big wooden butterflies, and they stick them up on the wall of their house, on the outside. And I've seen those, and I'm one of these really weird people, I see butterflies on the wall of the house, and I go, why? And you know, there's no economic advantage to putting a butterfly up on the outside of your house. You're not getting paid to do it. In fact, you probably paid somebody else money for the wood or for the butterfly. You certainly went to some time and trouble to attach a butterfly to the outside of your house. Yet, People do it. People do it by the hundreds. They do it by the thousands. There are butterflies all over the place. And if they're not butterflies, there's flower gardens and roses and curtains in the window and all that kind of stuff that people do on the outside of their houses. And even people who live in apartments, they decorate their balconies. Now, why do they do this? There's no economic advantage to doing this. There's no return on investment, no ROI. But they do it because they are part of a community. They are part of a network. They are sharing, not the butterfly per se, but they're sharing of themselves. And the way people see their house or see their balcony matters to them. The second butterfly thesis is essentially the thesis that demonstrably people will share. And in fact, I would argue that that's a more natural behavior, whole argument on naturalism bracketed, than commerce and selling and buying and profits and all of that. At its heart, connectivism is the thesis that knowledge is distributed across this network of connections, and that learning, knowing and learning, is therefore being able to construct and traverse and work within these networks. Understanding that if we have one of these networks, it's going to be not complicated but chaotic. Learning or working with it isn't understanding some sort of set of principles. It's, well, as Marshall McLuhan would say, it's like getting into a warm bath. It's different every time, but you know you're going to like it. I made up that second part. Just now, I probably shouldn't have. So, George Siemens and I last fall offered a course called Connectivism and Connective Knowledge, where we attempted to do two things. We attempted, first of all, to articulate this principle of connectivism, which I'm doing more or less well here. And secondly, and I think probably more importantly, to instantiate that principle, the idea being that we teach by doing. And so we set up this course, and George did a whole pile of work. I don't know where he is. He's probably still tired. We set up a wiki with, you know, because it was, we had to do this through the University of Manitoba. Well, we didn't have to, but we did it through the University of Manitoba, and they kind of insisted that it be a course rather than what we would have done otherwise. So we set up a course outline. There's a start time and an end time. These are all artificial constraints that we would probably not normally have done. Set up the wiki, and we set up a course Moodle forum. Now, for those of you who are interested, if you map the network of a Moodle forum, you get one of those hub and spoke networks. You get influencers, you get loud voices, and then you get power games and mighty struggles as the two titanic egos collide. I know, because I'm always one of them. And we got that, pretty predictable. Which leads to the third theme, because in that course, one of the other huge titanic egos referred to me and George as, what was it, techno-communists. And so we're all the way from Ayn Randian individualism now techno-communism. And I want to go, lurkers of the world unite. I want to draw a distinction, and Nancy White talked a bit about this yesterday, distinction between groups and networks, and there's no way you can read that slide, I know. I can hardly read it, and I wrote it. But there's a distinction to be drawn between groups and networks. Groups are coherent. Networks are collections of interacting individuals. Groups emphasize sameness. Networks emphasize autonomy. Groups emphasize borders. You're in, you're out. You're signed up for the class, you're not. You're eligible to attend this educational institution, you're not. You're a teacher, you're a student. Networks are open. There are no tight boundaries. There's maybe a core. There's maybe a set of loosely interacting people. There's maybe a body of lurkers. People drift in, people drift out, we don't know. These are two very different kinds of organization, aren't they? Groups are complicated. Networks are chaotic. groups are hub and spoke networks. Networks are meshes. So anyhow, Nancy was talking yesterday about we network, and she's representing this, and sorry, Nancy, I don't mean to criticize you, but I'm gonna. But I need to draw this out because there is this tendency on the part of people, or I think it's some kind of natural tendency, to want to create some sort of scale. This is where I take in that bracketed discussion about sustainability. And people always want to draw a scale and say, oh yeah, no, it's all gradations on a scale, right? It's all, you know, like from atomism, and it's a nice, neat scale all the way over to techno-communism, but it isn't like that. Groups are very distinct from networks, and it's kind of like the distinction between the free and commercial, right? And, you know, and I get this a lot, too, because I advocate for open educational resources, and I have people come up to me and say, well, it's like it's free. What do you mean it's like it's free? Well, it's not, but it's... So what they've done is they've produced this scale where free is on one end and really expensive is on the other end, and then all the different values are in between. And what they've done is, what they've done basically is they've taken this binary thing and converted it into a scale where 99 of 100 positions on the scale represent their point of view. And I get the one at the far end. And so I resist the urge to say, well, it's more like a group, less like a network. It's either closed or it's not. It either emphasizes autonomy or it does not. It's either composed of a network or a mesh network or it's not. There isn't that gradation between them. The other thing that Nancy said, which I thought was insightful and worthwhile, and I won't be criticizing that, I give with one hand, I take with another one, is that networks, even social networks, are not simply about connecting people, they're about connecting these objects. These objects, remember these objects, the objects are the MacGuffins that we were talking about earlier. The objects aren't what we're after, but they're the thing that we play with. So in our network, in our group and networks, we're playing with these objects. So we come back to thinking about the object system and the object system revised. Now I can go on to a whole history of learning objects here and all of that and talk about how they were created and how the publisher stole them and then how they were dead and then how they were revised again, but I won't. But what I will say is in our networks, in our personal learning environments, we're still playing with objects. The objects look like learning resources. They look like content, and if you're not watching, you might think you're supposed to learn those contents, but you're not supposed to learn them. You're supposed to play with them and toss them around, repurpose them, think about them, reflect on them, evaluate them, dispose of them, do whatever you want with them, but absolutely not to learn them, because the learning isn't in the object, it's in the students. Here's one of those objects. Learning objects have come a long way. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the concept, this is what is known as a lolcat. L-O-L-C-A-T. The L-O-L stands for laugh out loud. The concept is really simple. You take a picture, preferably but not necessarily, of a cat. You attach to it some text, preferably but not necessarily in text speech. And preferably, but sadly, not necessarily something that is funny. And then you post it online or send it to all of your friends. Lolcats are a screen. But what makes lolcats really interesting is they are a form of communication that is not simply text, not simply sound either. It's not simply something that's going to slip by your cognitive reflection and become something that you've somehow memorized. It's something you have to look at, understand, read, contextualize. Lolcats are never funny except within a particular concept, context. I made the mistake once of putting up a lolcat, and it referred to a film called Warriors. How many of you have seen Warriors? Right, one, two. That's how many people would have found that lolcat funny. The rest of you would have Warriors come out and play. What? What do you mean? What? Warriors come out and play? I don't get it. So, lolcats have content within a specific context and from the perspective of a certain point of view. And it's putting this context together with the content of a lolcat that makes it funny. The lolcat makes you reflect on it. That's the kind of sort of thing, again, not being precise here, that constitutes communication, constitutes the new objects of learning. And our task as educators, interestingly, will be to produce these. But maybe not lolcats, maybe 100 word bits of text, or whatever we're good at. So, in this world of learning objects and educational objects and all of that, there's a whole industry that has been devoted to the concept of repositories and syndication. And there's a 2-hour long technical talk that can and probably should be given about all of these things. All I want to say is all of this industry has gone toward creating systems where we can take our resources, our lolcats, our 100 words of text, whatever it is that we produce, put them online in such a way that they can be aggregated, discovered, aggregated, and used by other people. Some of these are open, some of these are not. Some of these are open source, some of these are not. Some of these are specifically educational, some of these are photo libraries like Flickr, video repositories like YouTube, SlideShare repositories like SlideShare, and the rest of it. Now, we have all of that, and it's chaotic, and it's not managed, and it's a network, and it's a mesh network, so there's no influencers, and the reaction, always coming from the group side of the house, is someone's got to be in charge. Because what if these learners don't learn the right thing? What if this group of people somehow turns out bad? And what I want to argue is that these things self-organize, and they do so without the need for a manager. And of course, I have proof. Still, these are metronomes. As you can see, they're functioning independently. They're connected by a piece of wood. They have a different periodicity, so they're going at different speeds, and they started at different times. They are not intelligent creatures. They are obviously not being managed. There is no head metronome, no more than there's a head neuron in your head, no more than there should be a head network guru in the network, and yet, somehow, mysteriously, they self-organize. Because this is what mesh networks do. And I can let that play. Well, yeah, I'm obviously letting it, but you can see where this is headed, right? And we'll just let that go in the background. And You'll hear them getting closer, and then eventually it'll stop. Otherwise that would drive you crazy. The revolving planets and the pendulums and so on. Networks self-organize, and we understand, at least in part, the principles by which they self-organize. And these are principles of association. Here are three types of principles that describe the self-organization of neural networks, as described in the field of computer science, and this is the stop, but you heard at the end there, like, as though they were one. These are from the field of what is called connectionism, not to be confused with connectivism, talking about how neural networks self-organize. There are different kinds of organization, different ways in which the individual entities in networks create knowledge, create awareness, create community, all without being managed. Again, in your brain, you can look at it and check, there is no head neuron. There's no neuron in charge. And yet, your brain is capable, if trained properly, of conscious, critically reflective thought. So all of that feeds into the architecture of the personal learning environment. And what I am attempting to do with the personal learning environment is to create a self-organizing mesh network in which individuals can be a part of this network, acting as a node in the network, but at the same time creating and informing and growing their own individual personal neural network, their brain, through interaction with this dynamic ecosystem of many voices, many opinions. So we come back to the connectivism course in the Moodle forum with the titanic egos and the clash of the titanic egos and the star and cluster networks. And what we did is we created instead a mesh network. We created a mechanism where everybody could go out to their own blog, their own space. They wouldn't need to worry about somebody coming in and slamming them the minute they posted a single one-sentence post up there. And we set up the network where everybody had a voice, everybody was equal, and they fed in and they fed out, and we built that using a tool called Grasshopper. And Grasshopper is the next instantiation of the personal learning environment. It is what my website software became. So here we have Grasshopper that it takes in the content, it creates web pages automatically. What I did is had everybody set up their own blogs. All of these blogs have their RSS feeds in that, just like the repository software that we saw. The eprints and the dspace and the YouTubes and the Flickers, except it's their own blog. Grasshopper aggregated all of these different feeds together and then presented them, it would reorganize them, map them, and present them as an output feed, and members of the course could subscribe to this, did subscribe to this, and what we did is basically we created student-to-student communication without centralized mediation, without the instructor mediating, without the loudest voice in the class mediating. So out of this, we built the other course components. We built the daily, which was the course equivalent of a daily newsletter. People began to refer to that as the lifeline in the course, and it let them keep track of all these, because, you know, you got, well, we had 2,200 people in the course. We had 170 separate blogs being populated, and 1,870 people in the course consistently, beginning to end, subscribed to this newsletter. And it was something to hang on to so that, you know, people could at least see some part of the network. Nobody sees all of the network in a mesh. There is no overarching view. So we had the feed harvesting in the course. So here we are harvesting all the individual feeds from all the individual blogs. And then all of these components together create, and this is a part of a diagram that one of the students created, creates this dense mesh network. And this mesh network is the model of the course. Normally we think of a course, it looks like one of those hub and spoke networks, right? Here's the course, here's all the chapters, and here's all the discussion areas and so on. Our course looked like a mesh network. That's what the structure looked like. The internet of 2007 is still hub and spoke. It's still central services, these online services, even blogs are served by online hosts like bloggers, social networks like Facebook or LinkedIn or MySpace. These are all these online services. Even tagging in Twitter, and I guess the Twitter thing is going furiously. I don't know because I can't see it. I need a big mirror there and then some way of reading backwards. All of these are still online hub and spokes kind of networks, but it's beginning to change. The internet of 2009, and this only began recently and kind of made it hard for me to do this talk, because normally I come in and do Web 2.0 in education, but we've gone past now Web 2.0 in education, and we are moving toward what the next internet will look like, and the personal learning environment will play a central role in this next internet. What will it look like? Well, where we are now is having some way of bringing the content in and then putting it on a web page. You see page flights here, and each one of those boxes represents an individual RSS feed. And we're moving beyond that, so now these feeds, instead of coming into some sort of central website, they come into whatever. The jargon that's being used now to describe this is the jargon of widgets and gadgets. And the reference there at the bottom is a reference to a WC3 discussion paper on the widget and gadget landscape. And here it is. They all, Yahoo, Google, Microsoft, and the rest, they all have some version of this. If you want a quick and dirty characterization of what a widget is, imagine a web browser with the web page and then all the stuff around it, and then take everything away that's a web browser, and what you have left is a widget. So a widget is the web browser without the browser part. So, and in the jargon of the field, the browser part is called the Chrome, because it's all decoration, right? That's why Google, when they created a browser, what they called it was Chrome, right? Because it's the decoration, but what they're after is the bit in the center that isn't the browser. So this bit in the center needs something to run on, because it can't just sort of run by itself. It's not magic. And that's called a widget engine. A widget engine is like a browser, except you don't see it and it has no Chrome. You see why you have to be a philosopher to do any of it? Because you get into these non-existentials that actually have some sort of meaning. Anyhow, the main point here is we're moving from this website-based reality to this widget-based reality. Google Wave is a bit of an example of that. But even more significant, in my mind, is something called Opera Unite. Because we are also going from the world where web servers sit out there in webland, and now web servers sit on your own desktop. So now you have widgets, which are browsers without the browsers, and now you have browsers, which are really web servers. And you might think, well, what does that mean? What that means is you yourself can have your own web server on your own computer that other people can access, and while your browser is running, your web server is running. Turn off your browser, your web server stops. And so now we have this situation where the personal learning environment becomes one of these browsers, one of these web servers. You yourself manage your own version of Blogger. You yourself manage your own version of Flickr. And so the personal learning environment becomes your personal web server, your web server that brings stuff in, your web server that sends stuff out. Where does it send stuff out to? Widgets and gadgets. It's a mess. But it's a really neat mess, and I'm sorry I'm not doing as good a job of making this clear as I could, but I'm trying to draw out the idea that we've got this chaotic, mesh-like, personal server-like, widget-like network being built now, and being built by a lot of really smart people. And all this stuff that you know of as Web 2.0 is going to transmogrify into the stuff of webs and widgets and gadgets and personal server stuff. If you want to play with this yourself, there's something that's been out for about a year called the Plain Old Web Server, or PoW, which is a Firefox extension. And PoW is exactly as the name describes. You install this extension, you turn your Firefox browser into a web server. What I want to do is turn my Firefox web server into an identity server so that I don't need a centralized identity manager. I'll turn my Firefox web server into an OpenID server, and every time I go to a website, my personal web server will tell the website who I am and sign in for me, because I hate passwords. So, to summarize, what a mess. But we have these networks of interactions, these aggregating, remixing, repurposing, feeding forward, chaos, confusion. But that chaos, confusion is a world in which you, as learners, live, and you learn not by aggregating and consuming content, but by remixing it, repurposing it, sharing it, and thereby growing your critical capacities. You have the personal learning center,
which is probably your browser, but it's also your personal web server. We have a diverse network where diversity is encouraged, I was going to say worshipped, but that's maybe a bit too extreme, but valued, and the dominant characteristic of this web, where we encourage multiple views, multiple perspectives, where we don't try to have shared community, shared values, shared concepts, but rather we have differing values, differing communities, differing concepts, and the learning takes place in the interaction among these. We have a network that is connected and interactive, but not like a group integrated, not into some big enterprise-y kind of thing, but more of a Weinberger in small pieces loosely joined kind of thing. And crucially, because it doesn't work otherwise, we have a network that is open, a network in which everybody can play, a network in which there are not dominant voices, and most importantly, we don't have that little voice whispering in our ear, jumping our cognitive capacities and making us learn and feeding us propaganda. We have a network where we can participate as fully engaged, reflective, critical, creative, equal partners. And that's the kind of model of learning that I'm working toward. And I wish I could have been a bit clearer with that today, but I think you kind of get the fuzzy sort of picture. And I thank you all for your time.